Joe Bobby!
I'm Jamie Roberts.
I'm Robert Lendrum.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the films that had you running away, but coming back for more.
Rob, we are coming back, or shall I say, we are going back. We are going back,
back.
We are going back to our youth, to our childhood, to our national pastime, to America's pastime, but we're not American, we're Canadian.
Hey, do it. Do it. He's in
We are going back. We are going back to baseball, Rob.
Yeah, so our first thriller. Back when we started this podcast, we kept writing things like, we review horrors and thrillers. And I don't think we've reviewed a single thriller.
We've never done a thriller.
Episode 46. We finally, or whatever we're on, we're finally hit a thriller.
47.
Is it right? So yeah. This is our first non-horror film that we're reviewing. And we're reviewing, what's the director's name?
This is Tony Scott, man. This is Tony Top Gun. Scott.
You're everyone's problem. That's because every time you go up in the air, you're unsafe. I don't like you because you're dangerous.
That's right.
Nice. Man, I am dangerous.
Right. So this is Tony Scott's The Fan, 1996, starring Robert De Niro and Blade.
Wesley Snipes. It's a special occasion because we have a host of the Dark Side of Sports, who I think is going to color the conversation tonight in an amazing way. We have the one and only Winston McMartin on the show tonight. Welcome, man. How you doing?
Thanks so much, guys, for having me. I'm doing great. I really love the podcast, and I like you going into the sports field now. You're moving. You're getting more out there. Yeah.
Me and Jamie have been trying to do a sports movie for a while, and I think we mentioned this one a while ago because it was one of the only sports ones we could think of. But we definitely, when we see like any sport stuff in a horror movie, we end up talking about that for like 10 minutes, like when we reviewed Black Friday or Black Christmas, and we mentioned the goalie who's – we only see him in his goalie uniform for about 30 seconds, but we went on about that for about 4 minutes. So we were definitely looking for a sports movie to do, but not really many sports horrors out there, eh?
So, Winston, you have a podcast, The Dark Side of Sports. Can you just tell us a little bit about the podcast, how it came about, and sure. Kind of what you're doing with that?
Yeah, well, as you guys know, sports are not all just fun and games. There's, you know, murder, mayhem, and there's psychopaths, just like in The Fan.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel that a lot of the times we measure athletes, we hold athletes to a higher scale than... And so when they have their downfall and they lose it or get into stuff, into crazy stuff, we are a little surprised, quite surprised by that. So I'm just interested in the story. And how I got into it is actually, I go back to the early days of Blue Jays. I remember when I was a kid, I watched the very first Blue Jay game. And there was a guy named Doug Ault who played first base, I think, for the Blue Jays. And he was he got the very first hit for the Blue Jays ever in that game, in the opening game. He ended up hitting 2 home runs in the game. So, you know, as a kid, I was kind of, I always remember the name Doug Ault. And he kind of just disappeared. But then, maybe 20 years ago, I heard he had killed himself. He had shot himself. And I thought, my God, you know, the highs and lows of being a sports... I never did get the actual... There wasn't much...
Those Canadian winters, eh?
Well, no, he wasn't Canadian, but I'm just... There wasn't a lot of...
Minus 41.
I didn't hear a lot of the background or what caused him to do that, just like he had a sudden downturn in his life. But just to hear how someone you remember as a kid is this great hero and then he kills himself, it just made me think about the darker side of things, and then I got into some of the other stories that I've been covering on my podcast, like Aaron Hernandez or Kirby Puckett had a bit of a downfall there.
Winston,
The Oscar Pistorius one, I guess everyone's heard the Oscar, the Blade Runner guy.
Man, we must be of the same vintage. Like, you know what I mean? This movie is about baseball, and I didn't know that about Doug, so I know it happened a while ago,
it came as a surprise to me. And then when I heard that, I thought, oh, well, another Dark Side. Oh, it's too bad.
But those Blue Jays, Exhibition Stadium, you know what I mean? I think that's why, for me, watching it the first time and just doing the podcast on it tonight, you know what I mean? I love my dad, Don Roberts. He took me to
Don gets on this pod a lot.
What's up, Dad?
No one... Exhibition
Snow on
Stadium,
the field.
I know you're saying this isn't a horror, but that was almost a horror, Exhibition Stadium, to watch a baseball. Did you ever go? And the general admission was way behind the fence. And then if it was really full, you had to sit so far away from the field, you felt like you had to use binoculars just to see the play. And it was
Really? Yeah, I just like 1985. You know what I mean? Yeah. Mullinix, Orge, like that was like the team. Oh, yeah. The Blue Jays had only been in Toronto for like 6 years, and I went to go see the Warped Tour down in Exhibition Stadium. I feel like it worked better as a concert venue than it did as a baseball stadium. But getting into this film, you know, with Robert De Niro and Snipes, Wesley Snipes, not his first baseball role.
Well, you may run like Mays, but you hit like shit.
This is an interesting film because this is Tony Scott. This guy's a huge director. He's done a lot of big movies. And this one, you know, he'd build up a great reputation in Hollywood. This had like a $60 million budget. But Rob, like, this didn't do very well at the theaters, man.
18.6 is what I read as the return. I think that was on Wikipedia. But yeah, and one of the reasons I've heard is that apparently Tony Scott knows nothing about baseball.
He's British.
And sometimes you can actually see in this movie, we'll get into that, but like the way it's shot, the way some of the things that come up. But there's some weird like disconnect there with like the game itself that doesn't sort of translate into this film the way maybe it could have. So before we get too deep into this film, one of the things we like to do, Winston, and we're going to put you on the spot here. We like to do a little thing called the one-line challenge.
Okay, one-line challenge.
This is where because we don't like to do the plot so much on Running Scared, at least not in like a chronological way where we go through scene by scene, we like to kind of summarize the movie up top at the beginning of the pod so everybody knows what it's about. But you got to do it in one sentence and kind of cover the whole thing. And we always do it off the top of our head. The joke here is that just means, Jamie, you're so bad at it. We don't write these down.
No, like we're so bad at it.
Okay.
Like
it's kind of like
coherent sentence.
Yeah, and sometimes we try to do like a log line, like a way you'd find it on IMDb or IMDb, but other times we try to kind of like cover off some plot points, and basically we muff it up. But the point is, we knock off as much plot as we can in a single line. So, okay. Jamie, should we go before him, or should we make Winston just go straight honestly, in, walk him into the fire?
You know what? We can't do that. It's like when we had Ari Fleeman on, we were going to throw him like his hockey team's already terrible. Then we... You know what? I'm okay to go first.
All right.
Oh, you go first.
Man, honestly, I've started to write these down.
Oh, what?
But then,
But then
I get so nervous that I can't even read my own writing. Okay, let's go.
All right. I'm counting you in. Ready? 3, 2, 1.
The Fan. A psychotic baseball fan / father who never realized his true dreams embarks on a downward spiral into madness, and at the end of it leads to murder and to his own demise. The Fan.
Not bad.
That actually wasn't too bad. I got a little nervous at the end because we have a guest on, but.
All right, count me in.
All right. 3, 2, 1.
The Fan.
Oh, that's great, Rob.
A failed knife salesman, a failed father, and a failed baseball player tries to live out his dream of ultimate fandom and have his team win by cheering on a hometown hero, only to have his relationship with that hero devolve into murder and killing a Philadelphia Phillies star of the 90s, John Kruk. The Fan.
Did he realize his ultimate fandom?
Wasn't that his thing? He was like, he kind of was like, he's such a Giants fan that he's like trying to boost Ray Bird's confidence. Isn't that kind of like how it starts before it starts going to hell?
Yeah. Well,
let's not give it all away. Winston's still got to go here.
Oh, Winston, I'm probably going to be a little more, my line will be a little shorter.
Actually probably better.
I can reference other movies in my line. I can do whatever I want.
Yeah. Oh, whatever you want.
Yeah, everyone. We have no rules on this thing. We're going to catch you.
Here we go.
Okay, Rob, count them in.
3, 2, 1.
The Fan. You remember Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver? He's no longer in New York. He's in San Francisco and he loves baseball. But he's just as angry as he was in that other film. And he is going to cause some mayhem on the diamond. That's it. That's the fan.
Oh, that's good. That's Blood on the diamond. Well, Travis Bickle. Blood on the diamond.
Yes, Travis Bickle. I couldn't help, when I watched this, I couldn't help think of Back to the Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Although I know a lot of people have mentioned Falling Down. Now, was Falling Down
that's right Michael before? Michael Douglas.
I know that's Michael Douglas, but I mean, was that film right before this or?
Falling Down was 93.
Okay.
So it precedes this by 3 years.
Precedes it by 3 years. Can we actually just go there real quick? Because that's a question that we have, and I can just splice it later. But Winston, you mentioned Taxi Driver. Yeah. Do you think that he ever, that Gil Renard, that's
should he save this for the character section?
No, I just, you know, just because he mentioned it, I just kind of want to see if, do we ever get to that Taxi Driver level of madness in this film? Does Gil ever reach there just in, what do you think?
It's a good point, because I found in Taxi Driver with his physical, remember he does the mohawk.
Exactly, the mohawk, right?
And he's working out and he has all the guns attached to his body.
Yeah.
I found that Gil maybe psychologically is changing, but you don't notice it physically as much. Mm-hmm. So I kind of agree in a sense that, you know he's going to go nuts because you just know it's De Niro's going to do that. But I found it, it wasn't as convincing as Taxi Driver, I found. The journey into madness, so to speak.
Speaking of taking fandom to a whole new level, let's do a little top five here, Jamie.
Yes.
And Winston, with the help of Winston McMartin, of course.
Yes.
Let's think of the top five fan attacks in sports. Jamie, you want to begin?
Yeah. I'm going to come in with Colombian soccer player Anders Escobar. Do you know about this incident?
Me? I've heard of this, but I don't really know the story.
It was on the Dark Side of Sports.
Yeah, that's where I probably heard it.
Oh, was it? Okay, so fuck, maybe you should go with that one, not me. Maybe I'll go. You know what? Okay, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. This was the Colombian national team that had like the famous player Valderrama, who everybody knows had like the big blonde sort of big poofy hair, right?
Yeah.
So this is I want to go like 94 World Cup, and there was an own goal scored by Escobar. I don't know if it was a knockout game. I don't know if it was a group game, but he was fucking shot and killed. Am I correct with that?
That you were correct, yeah. I think it was an earlier game in the tournament, because they didn't even... I don't even think they made the knockout round. That's what was so disappointing to the fans at home about it.
They came home
early, and they were in Colombia when the World Cup was still going on in the States at the same time. And I think that really kind of magnified it more, because you have all these fans like on TV watching the other teams playing, and here's your Colombian team back, and here's the guy who scored the own goal in the bar beside you that night. And he got shot after, being in a bar with whoever,
So it was like a bar altercation. It wasn't like a mafia hit or something, or mob hit or something.
It was a bit of both, apparently. The drug cartel, like, it seemed to be just a bunch of unruly guys in a bar that were insulting him, and then he left, and then they caught up to him in the parking lot, and I guess shot him out in the parking lot and left him to die. But then later it turned out that maybe this guy was involved with the drug cartel, and they had gambled so much money and lost on the Team Colombia that they were so upset they had to take their vengeance out on him.
I'll come with number two, and they made a movie about this one, Tanya Harding.
Ooh.
With the old crowbar to the knee on Nancy Kerrigan. This was like...
she didn't do it.
Yeah. Well, she didn't do it. And this is maybe why it maybe shouldn't really be in our top five, because it wasn't really a fan, but it was someone that Tanya hired to do it for her, right?
Wasn't it Jeff Galooly?
Yes. He gave her the old Galooly.
That guy had his 15 minutes. Galoolia.
But he wasn't a fan, was he? It was more or less hired by Harding. So maybe this one kind of doesn't quite work in our list, but still a good example of... competitiveness driving people to a new limit. Winston, do you remember the Monica Seles attack?
I think that has to be the top. The most tragic one. I mean, she didn't die, but that's very similar, I guess, in a sense to, because you have Gil Renard in our film attacking. Was it Juan Primo?
Yes. Juan Primo. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So similarly, you had a fan obsessed with Steffi Graf and was very much jealous of Monica Seles. She was, you know, pushing Graf. I think she was about to take over the number one ranking, and this guy said, no way, Steffi's never going to be to overtake. So yeah, he showed up at a match and stabbed Monica right between the shoulder blades in the back, and much like Juan Primo was murdered. Well, she wasn't murdered, but I mean, she was seriously injured. I know she bounced back, but I don't think she was ever quite the same.
No, how could you be? Like, that's a serious attack right in the back of your neck.
Even just your psyche. Forget about how you physically respond, right? Just, exactly. You'd always be so nervous.
I got one that could probably put the chair on top of our list here, and I'm going to give our number one spot to Mike Milbury.
Mike wasn't beating the guy. Mike just stopped the guy from trying to kick him.
I grabbed the shoe and sort of gave it a double pump. And hit him with his penny loafer, not in the head, not in the face, on his leg. And the worst thing.
Who actually decided to go into the stands?
That was the inverse.
And
the
just inverse. He beat the shit out of those fans.
He should be at the top of the list because, yes, he was the guy who did something about it. He didn't take shit from the fans. He beat them. And didn't he take the guy's shoe off and beat him with the shoe?
Like he literally, and you see it, like he literally took off his fucking business shoe and
started. Well, I like that choice, Rob. You turned it around for number one.
That was the original Malice at the Palace. Like, we look at, you know what, we look at that when Ron Artest went in there, but if you go back and look, Mike Milbury went up into the stands and took the man's shoe off and started beating him with it.
Man, like, the funniest thing about that.
Is there anything that is more emasculating than that?
It's also like with Ron Artest, he's playing basketball, right? Like, he's got shoes on. Mike Milbury's wearing skates. He's climbing through the seats with skates on to fight this man.
What about when Domi pulled him into the box?
Oh, that was a great one, too. I love that one.
Now, you've had...
Let him in! Let him into the box! Whoa! All right. Watch the lawsuit, Ty! Watch the lawsuit!
You know what I mean? It looked like the Brooklyn Brawler.
When Domi squirted the guy with water, and then he fell over the this man is so big that he actually collapsed the window, like the boards, into the penalty box, where Domi puts him in a headlock and just starts feeding him. All right, let's get into our pod here and get where we're going to start is with the characters. So let's start with the first character of this film, who's not necessarily the star of the film. I mean, he's definitely a co-star. This is a two-star kind of film, but I think we're watching the evolution of one character more so than the other. So let's start with Wesley Snipes as Bobby Rayburn.
Willie Mays Hayes. he was on a run at this point.
His career-wise, you mean? Yeah.
Oh, my. We're talking, these are like high-leverage roles, Rob. Mm-hmm. Classic roles. Demolition Man. White Men Can't Jump.
Oh, it is hard goddamn work being this good.
Shut the fuck up.
What else was he in? Passenger 57. Do you guys ever watch that?
Yeah, I think I saw that.
Always Bet on Black.
I don't remember that, but I guess it didn't stick in my head that well. And he's 2 years away from Blade.
He is not just your typical black athlete. You kind of get that at the beginning. He's rolling around in his Hummer. Like, do you remember when Hummers were very popular?
Yeah.
Like, if you had money, you bought a Hummer. Yeah. And then he's got John Leguizamo as his agent, who's like the original Piven. And he's like, they're going through and he's fast talking. But then you start to see a little bit of a different side to Snipes in this film, eh, Rob?
Yeah, they set him up to be like that obnoxious kind of character, but then very quickly you realize he doesn't really say anything that's obnoxious. He doesn't really do anything that's obnoxious. And very quickly you realize he's a much more straight, and he's very measured. The thing you learn about the character is that he's a perfectionist. He's constantly trying to make himself better and better. And because of that, he's actually very restrained in the way he works most of the time. It was funny you mentioned that about Willie Mays Hayes, though. This being Snipes' second baseball movie, apparently he didn't know how to swing a bat. And they had Cal Ripken Jr. as his batting teacher on set, as well as John Kruk. So, I mean, this guy was getting advice from some of the best in the business.
I was going to say the relationship with his son seems to kind of make him more real, three-dimensional.
Yeah.
He definitely loves his son, and there's more to his character that way.
It hits him hard when he goes in to see that little boy who's dying in the hospital of cancer, and then he goes, oh, what's your name? Sean? Oh, Sean. He looks over at his agent like, really? That's my son's name, right?
Yeah.
And then automatically you're thinking, so what's up with this kid? And that's one of the connections that you see between Gil and Snipes. There's a lot of kind of I'm going to say hidden things, but just like things that kind of bubble underneath the surface there, where they're both trying to connect with their kids in different ways, you know, it means
they're both separated.
Yeah. To varying degrees of success. Like, I think you know, it's alluded that Snipes has lost his wife and he's trying to be a father, but.
Oh, is that your read? No. His mom is alive. The mom's alive. Because he says later on the film.
Oh,
he says,
he's coming off the private plane, right? But I guess they're not together anymore.
Yeah, because Sean, when he goes into the water and gets into trouble, he goes, "Do not tell your mother about this." So he's definitely divorced.
So, but he's also struggling to be a dad, and I think it would be really difficult when you were away so much, right? You're in a new city, you're getting traded, you're on all those road trips. Like, I definitely think he struggles with that. Maybe the father that he feels like he should be.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about him is, like, we learn piece by piece how superstitious he is, and I think that relates to his perfectionism. Like, his number obviously becomes a big thing in the whole film. But he always kisses the chain. He has to touch the chain before he bats, which he loses in the first play in the outfield. Like you said, the same name as his own son for this kid in the hospital. There's a couple other examples where he, like, has real, like, superstitions about things that, like, you can tell, like, he's got a lot in his head about, like, how he has to do things the same way every time, or he's got that, like, thing that you hear about certain athletes. Like, Sidney Crosby apparently is one of these guys who has, like, a million routines.
Yeah, but, like, I think athletes are like that.
Yeah.
I think, Rob, we just talked about this, man. We're, like, in midlife, and just to keep shit sane, we got to keep stuff on, you know what I mean, in a routine, right? Just to kind of keep the ball rolling because all the pressures. I think the superstition manifests itself out of just needing to have, like, this hyper routine because your life is so, like, these are big dollars these people are dealing with. It's a lot of responsibility. It's a lot of attention. I think anything that they can hold on to that grounds them, I think is important. And you see that. But he's asking for the number. Did you not think Primo was being a little bit of an asshole in this film? Like,
You know what's funny? They say it in the film at one point, like, and it made sense to me. It's like, why didn't the management take care of this before he came over?
Like, what the fuck is going on with this clubhouse, man? Like their manager, you can call in at any hour of the day and get Bobby Rayburn. Like, I don't think
when Gil, like, calls the clubhouse.
So no less than, like, six times in this movie can people get access to Bobby Rayburn. Like, let me ask you, could you call in right now and get access to Vladdy?
No,
you couldn't.
I heard he just flew to Florida though on Twitter. Somebody said they were beside him on the.
That's different, right?
He's very likable. Like, I think you want to dislike him at the beginning, but very quickly you realize he's not what they first set him up to be, and then I think he becomes really likable. And then even when he breaks it down to Gil about why he had to say to himself, I got to stop caring about what everybody thought, and Gil takes it the wrong way. Like, Gil takes it like, what do you mean you gave up on baseball? He's like, no. Like, if he didn't explain this, but what he meant was I had to stop caring what everybody else felt so that I could just worry about myself and do it my way and let the pressure off myself, and then I can perform again. But when I mount the pressure up, I can't perform very well. And you know, Gil fucking misunderstands this.
You know, Curly, I just stopped caring, man.
What?
I just stopped caring.
You stopped caring? What do you mean?
Yes, Gil thinks he's disrespecting the sport.
Yeah.
Where he's just saying, no, like, looking at it a different way, and then it helps me perform better. So, yeah.
Well, Gil's a traditionalist, right?
Yeah.
He believes things should be done a certain way, as his conversations with his son at his little league game. But yeah, you know, should we talk about Gil? Is that a good little segue to get into Gil, Robert De Niro?
Yeah, I think that's the meat of this film, right? So we really do need to, let's talk about De Niro. What'd you guys think, just performance, before we get into the character? De Niro's such, like, an A-list actor. He's in his prime here. But what do you think of this performance? Winston.
Winston?
I did like the scene. I do have to admit, I did like the scene at the Little League game with his kid.
What? That's okay.
It's not okay. He's throwing too hard. He almost took his head off. Hey, coach.
Yeah.
Slow down. This is Little League.
I know.
Leave him alone, Joe.
Hey, mind your fucking business.
Hey, coach, mix in some strikes. What are you doing?
There seemed to be...
Mix in some strikes.
No, but I mean, I did like sort of the maybe the perspective from the child of being split between the two parents. It did seem to have. But as the movie went on, I kind of didn't. I thought he was just sort of going through the motions of Travis Bickle and just like he's, and I guess he did the Cape Fear role as well, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Oh, that was such
a
good movie.
I just kind of like he's been there and done this before. I didn't really think he brought, I don't know. I almost, like you said earlier, Jamie, I think that Tony Scott did this because of De Niro. Like, did,
yeah, I was,
Rob mentioned, yeah.
Or Rob mentioned that. I just think maybe he was too big for that role. I don't know.
A little bit like his past is preceding him a bit here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think it would have been a good film for somebody that we hadn't seen perform this kind of role before, so that we could watch them like become something that we hadn't seen before. But with De Niro, we've seen it before.
Exactly. Like, I thought, oh, okay, he's one of these characters from, you know, Taxi Driver, from Cape Fear, and he's going to lose it. You're expecting it, right? So, but maybe another actor you would be done in a different way, and you wouldn't quite as find it as predictable. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, because like I said, Brad Pitt was trying to get this role, and he probably hadn't done anything like this yet. Anyway, but you're right. Potentially a case where the actor was just too big for the shoes of the role, you know? And there's some funny parts to this to me where Gil is like, he's like this down on his luck knife salesman who speaks in puns. And I was almost like, I wanted the puns almost like ramped up too far, where he's almost like Mr. Freeze in Batman and Robin, where every line was going to be a knife line. But there was like four knife puns that he drops in this movie that I thought was like cringy, but at the same time I was like, oh, I get it. He's like a cheesy door-to-door salesman, so like that's his thing.
So he's positioned that way, but one of the things I didn't think was totally clear is that like this is his father's company.
Yeah.
So this is his dad's company. So his dad, I guess, originally built it. And at one point, he says, when he's being fired, my father started this company. And then he said, your father made beautiful knives. Your father wasn't a businessman. So I guess it leads, like, he's a perennial fuck up, right? Like, his dad started the business, but he wasn't able to kind of take the reins of it at some point. So you know what I mean? The writing's
like
that,
he was pushed to just a salesman job. Like, he didn't even, he's not even, got, an office or anything.
But also, yeah, exactly. He's got the tie. He's got the van. He's going around from call to call. But he's putting in an honest effort, right? And that's where he's not like, you know, the De Niro verbose, the whole thing right from the start. Like, he's trying to make his calls. He's trying to go in there. Like, he's talking to the guy about knives. You got the little pecker? You got any kayaks?
You got any kayaks?
You got to be out of your fucking mind. Kayaks?
The guy who's watching the surveillance camera just looking at
kayaks?
Looking down
kayaks.
Girls' dresses the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
And then he starts to go, what the fuck are you talking about, kayaks? I don't want to fuck the kayaks, you fucking asshole.
And so certainly I'm stepping to the side a little bit here, but one of the ways that the picture is painted, there's something off about Gil, is through his interactions with his ex-wife.
Ellen,
played by Patty.
She loves him, eh?
D'Arbenville. Yeah, and that's the thing. They never tell you what their relationship was and why it fell apart, but you can tell it was fucking bad because she fucking hates this guy with every ounce of her body.
Let go of my son. Let go of my son.
He's my son too.
Don't remind me. Get off him.
He's my son too.
You are not going to ruin the rest of our lives, all right? Tim, call the cops.
Her first line is, just so you know, I'm against this. Just so you know, Gil, I'm against this. And he goes, he's like, he's booked the meeting. This is how dumb he is. He knows he's on thin ice. Okay, she's threatened to call the police.
Yeah.
Yet he thinks it's a good idea to leave his son in the stadium. Fucking, he leaves the stadium at 2:17. He's supposed to make the 2:30 call. And all the while, he's been sitting in the stands. He's all starting fights. He's going, let's play some fucking baseball. He's telling the old lady with the Stanford hat to piss off.
Oh, yes.
Are you out of your mind? Are you out of your fucking mind?
What are you fucking looking at? And the kid is sitting there like, could you imagine that? I don't know if you have kids, Winston, but Rob and I both have, have sons that are 5 and 6. And I can't even, it's like, have you ever been in the stands where there's a guy cursing behind you and your wife's nudging you to say something, but you don't want to because you know it's going to cause a fucking issue.
That's right.
Like, oh, you know what I mean? Just my ex-girlfriend used to,
and he's got the height advantage. He's like,
oh yeah, exactly. He's in the row behind you. So
he's punching over you, right? Like
he's punching down.
Yeah.
But you just like,
you mentioned the Stanford lady though. I almost agreed with De Niro or, Gill in that scene because you know, you're at a game. It's like, it's none of your business. I'm cursing my son out. Give me a break. It's none of your business. Forget it. Like, she was like, give him the nosy neighbor look.
Thing. Totally. Yeah. So besides ruining his kid, Gil is also obsessed with the Giants. And so we find out that he loves Rayburn because he saw him as a kid play Little League in the same, Rayburn's from San Fran.
Yeah.
So he's seen him grow up.
And
he's trying to boost Rayburn's ego. This is what we were talking about earlier, but the first scene, he's on the phone trying to boost Rayburn's ego. So he's like this demented Care Bear trying to
Care Bears count down. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Who's that coming from somewhere up in the sky?
Trying to get Rayburn his ego up.
I was just going to throw out there is that the scene where he's on the radio talk show?
Yeah, first scene of the movie. He's in the car.
Did you see who's behind the glass there? The broadcast technician guy? Did you guys see that? Jack Black.
Yes, it was Jack Black. I thought it was the guy from Total Recall. Yeah. But it was Jack Black. Jack Black. Yes, I did see that. I didn't put it in the notes, Winston, but thank you for mentioning that.
What, the musician?
No, Jack Black.
No, he works on the radio show, and he runs the board for Alan Barkin.
Oh, Jack Black, the actor. I was trying to think of who the hell's Jack Black? Of course.
I'm trying to get a reference point.
This is a huge
cast,
and I didn't even. Yeah, you're right. The fact that I missed that because John Leguizamo's in this movie. The two actors who are on the radio, I forget their names, but those are both
the girl. Yeah, she's.
You've seen them in a million films.
Yeah, she was in The Last Boy Scout, I think.
Yeah, Alan Barkin.
Yeah, and even the guy though, he's the co-host. He's in a million things.
Was he in Total Recall? Oh.
Yes. Yes, he's the guy who sweats, and that's what tells Arnold to shoot him.
Total Recall.
You guys are good.
We have a podcast,
that's
man.
Crazy.
47 episodes.
Does Jack Black speak? So Jack Black has a non-speaking role in this?
He's kind of mouth something.
Yeah, he's on the line. We got a caller. Yeah.
We got a caller on the line. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
But he's very, Gil's all in on Rayburn. You know, he's all in because they're asking Rayburn about Primo moving to left and Rayburn coming into center, and then Gil's like, bat's too steep, bat's 286. He's got 12 homers. Why shouldn't he move? You know, so he's kind of going on. He's defending him, but that is one of literally five times where he's able to actually talk or be around Rayburn before he actually goes.
I was
blown
away by the fact that the radio show lets the fans speak directly to the player. I was like, that would never, never happen.
That's right.
Yeah, never. It's always through, always through an intermediary. But
the fans get to call in with a question, but they don't get to be on the line at the same time as the athlete coming in for the interview.
Because you could just say something bad.
Yeah. But, don't you remember Corey Augustin calling in being like, hey, Pinball, what's up with your teeth?
No, you make a good
point. Why do you have to bring up some of my poorest moments in my life, Rob?
Yeah, put it all on Corey. You didn't have to own that one.
That's I had the dial-up phone and hey, Pinball. He was doing the late night, he's hawking Bibles. And he's...
really? You really
Pinball's religious. Michael Clemens is religious.
I didn't know you had done that. That's great. I mean, not is great, it, but very it, interesting.
It's
so they called in and they made fun of his teeth.
Rob's got a lot of dirt on me.
He's got big teeth. That's, I mean,
you can reveal a lot in a podcast.
You can, man. You can.
So one of the things we learned here is that Gil obviously hyper knows his Little League, San Fran Little League. He's a big fan of San Fran Little League, apparently, because he knows Rayburn from way back. And we also find out later on that Gil played Little League.
Yeah.
And that was the pinnacle of his
He won the
baseball
championship.
Career. He won the championship with a walk-off or something. And throughout the movie, he's constantly referring to his buddy Coop. And Coop turns out to be the catcher on his team. But we didn't realize until really near the climax that his team was his Little League team. Not a minor league Triple A team, which is what we are set up to believe. It was his fucking 12-year-old Little League team.
House League team.
And Coop
Coop says, I haven't talked to you since I was 12 or something.
And we were 12, Gil.
Yeah, when Gil kills him, he goes, "We were 12 in Little League," and it's almost thrown in a little bit out of nowhere.
Been something.
But the crazy part is throughout the film, Gil is quoting Coop over and over again. There's like three or four like fucking Yoda-like expressions of like how to play baseball. I'm like, how fucking smart was this 12-year-old Coop? This kid was like the Buddhist sayings that like help you understand the game of baseball.
He was Coop always. Yogi Berra.
He's the Yogi Berra of 12-year-olds.
Yogi Berra of Little League, yeah.
So it just kind of like, did you find that leap a little too much? Like, because if they had said minor leagues, like he had got to the minors, I thought, because that's what the movie's setting up. But then it leaps all the way to 12-year-old baseball, and I'm like, what the fuck?
But don't you find that sort of explains his upset? Like, that was his biggest moment was Little League, and he's still obsessed with that moment. That's all he thinks about getting to this day.
But but it's too far back. Like, it's like, to me, if he had done it in single A, it would have still made way more sense.
Yeah.
He does talk a lot about his time playing baseball. He does mention Coop a lot, but only it's at the end do you see that he's got that whole like baseball shrine in. I think it's in the garage. Like
it's in the Little League. It's in the stadium of the Little League park.
Is that where it is?
Did he not keep the son there, Sean?
Yeah, Sean is kidnapped and he's locked into like a locker room or something at the Little League stadium.
That's right.
Coop and Gil's got like a wall full of like conspiracy theory articles. But it's all
Rayburn
stuff.
Yeah, it's all Rayburn stuff. It's all like the hats that are that he's like, you know, those little hats you get like ice cream from Dairy Queen. He's got them all in there. It's like, those little hats, eh?
Yeah. Yes.
Collect them all.
Yeah, like you get Monopoly. Like a scoop of ice cream in it or something.
But then the thing is like also, okay, so here's another thing that irritated me was like, so I believe they say he had a walk-off and he won the game, did he not? Like he hit a home run or something as a Little Leaguer?
Yeah, it's in the headline right at the end. It's like one of the last scenes that, you know, Gil Renard game-winning shot.
But in the movie, he wants to pitch to Rayburn.
Mm.
So, and then he wants to throw knives at him. So it's all about the throwing and the knives. Yeah. So it's like he could have been a pitcher, which would have made more sense. Like you could have said, you know, he broke his arm or whatever. And so he couldn't make it or whatever to the bigs. But instead it's like, no, he won. Like it should have said, Gil Renard, like shutout or a no hitter or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
But why is he?
Maybe he's like Shohei Ohtani. He could pitch him with the best of them.
Did he win MVP?
Who?
I think Ohtani? Gil or Ohtani?
Ohtani. Yeah, Gil. I don't think Gil did. Ohtani.
I think so. Ohtani
win? I don't even know who won the MVP.
I don't remember, but I think he did.
Ohtani. But no, Gil is Gil is, you know, a guy
he's
who.
He's not right.
No, he's always. I think he's just a guy who always feels like he deserved more. He never quite made it, never quite had it. And I think everybody around him hasn't lived up to his expectation. And I don't think that he's lived up to expectation. I think that's where the fire or like the ember of his anger. And then it's eventually just manifests itself out. Like he's lashing out at the new husband. What is it? Ted. But his name's Tim. Hey, Ted. Like he almost beats this man in front of, you know, all those children at the baseball game. You know, when he goes to see him, right? He's already been like he's got the restraining order, and then he shows up at the little park when the son's there and his kid's in tears. Like he's got no clue. Like, he's just. Anyway, so is there anybody else?
I think there's maybe.
Is
only,
there anybody else?
There's one other character maybe I would mention is, you know, Jays fans will recognize a member of the Phillies' infamous Macho Row, John Crook.
Ah, what a day. Come out here and watch big league baseball. Eat some big league David sunflower seeds. You gotta love it.
John Crook.
Playing on the Giants in this movie. Batting both ahead and after Rayburn one scene, by the way. Did you guys notice that?
Didn't notice that.
There's a bad edit where he precedes Rayburn at bat, and then Rayburn's up to bat, and he's behind him in the batter circle, like waiting for his turn. Anyway, he's only got one line in the whole movie, and then he gets killed in the final scene by Gil, and I was like, yeah! Because as a Giants fan, we hated John Crook.
I didn't hate John Crook. I was like,
that guy could mash, man. Don't you remember? He was killing us in that series.
I hate the opposition. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. I don't hate individuals.
Yeah, I know. But he had a great series against us.
He was a lovable enemy, I guess.
He was. He was.
And the one other interesting thing, this is an IMDb trivia thing. So again, my sources tell me, IMDb trivia being my source, that John Crook apparently told Tony Scott a bunch of like baseball things to try to like you know, fix up a few problems in the movie, because apparently, like, one scene there was, you're in the locker room and you see like a stack of books, like there's like a little mini library in there, and John Crook was like, yeah, that would never fucking happen, there's no library in the fucking clubhouse. And John Scott just like blew him off. He's like, yeah, whatever, fuck off. And John, and apparently John Crook was kind of pissed because he's like, I'm a fucking professional baseball player. Trust me, this shit doesn't happen. Do you want like your movie to be realistic or not?
I got to go back and look. Where was the books? I couldn't tell. Every time they were in the clubhouse, it was so fucking dark.
Yeah, I don't know. There was no lights on in the clubhouse. That was the example I read about. But apparently Crook mentioned a bunch of things. And he was helping also with the batting, because I guess Wesley Snipes never really played much baseball. And they had to give him a batting coach. And apparently it was Ripken Jr. as well was helping him learn how to swing the bat properly. And so... go ahead, Winston, because maybe you got more on that.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, there are a lot of things, like the inaccuracies of, they had two guys in the, like, you know how when your team's up to bat, you'll have a guy in the batting, the on-deck circle, but you don't have both teams in the, so they were showing both teams at the same time in the on-deck circle. And then they showed one, I think they had one shot where Ray Byrne was announced to come to bat, and he came right out from the dugout. Like,
I saw that too. Yeah, there was a lot of weird things where, like they just did it for the movie, but like in reality it really kind of like hit anyone who's a baseball fan was like, what's going on here, this is odd.
And the rain, to say the least, right?
Oh, the rain. They're getting pelted with rain. Yeah, it's like call a it. Monsoon
call it.
Oh, you guys, you before know, you we hold- get to that scene though, because I got a whole theory on that.
Sorry.
Scene.
Okay, I jumped ahead, sorry.
No, that's fine, but like one thing I wanted to mention too is like, because you're right, like there's all these weird inconsistencies with the way it's filmed. There's this one scene where Ray Byrne hits himself into a double play, and they film it like it's so fucking dramatic. They're like, oh yeah, and it's like, dude, it's a double play.
Boy Scout.
Like if you just cut to a wide, we'd all see that this is a double play. But instead, they shoot it super tight to make it seem super dramatic, and it's like, it's a fucking 3-2-1 double play. Like it's not hard.
I think Juan Primo was the guy who got to. Thrown out at second.
Yeah.
But
like, you guys, when you watch baseball, it's a wide. It's usually a wide shot because you're looking at the whole field. And it's usually kind of obvious that a double play is happening. So I was just like, it felt a little off in that regard.
Rob, you know what else was off a little bit? I know Winston, Rob, you guys are a little bit closer to the game working in the industry. When Gil shows up at the bar, apparently where all the San Francisco Giants drink at, and like, do you think teams are that kind of cliquey and fractured? Because Rayburn comes in, he's clearly trying to like talk to his teammate, and like they're fucking not even paying attention to him. You guys go sits alone in a booth, and Crook's over there with Primo, and they're like, it seemed like Primo, as a Latin player, was with a couple other Latin players, like they didn't even acknowledge him. Do you think that is realistic? Like, Or like in modern professional sports, when there's millions of dollars on the line and there can be beef in the locker room, do you think it can be that kind of antagonistic?
I mean, I think it can.
Yeah, I think it can. Yeah, I don't think, really, not that we would know, like from first-hand knowledge.
To me,
it just
didn't seem, I'm like, maybe it's the teacher in me, man, but I was like, nobody's being kind.
No, I think it's cliquey. I think everyone tries to get along, but I definitely think there are like, you know, sub-cliques within every team, right? And the one thing with that scene that threw me was like, they just go to the titty bar, like it's no big deal, like no one's gonna be like, hey man, all the Giants are at the titty bar.
I know the Giants, like, they come here just to chill. That's the third time Gil can just go up and fucking hang out with them.
Yeah, I know. I just went to the strip club, and the entire Giants team was there. Really? Yeah, exactly.
The secret's out.
Yeah, like
although, oh my god, the funniest thing. Quick little side story. I was down in Cleveland for a conference, maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. And I walked into this bar and I was having dinner before, I was just going out, there was like an event at the night. And I saw like a big dude in a Cleveland t-shirt. I'm like, okay. And the guy goes, stupid me. I go, is there something going on here? He goes, oh yeah, Carlos Santana is having his birthday here. I go, fuck, I love his music, man. That's amazing. He goes, not the artist, idiot. It's the ball player from Cleveland. So anyways, the point is, I was an idiot thinking it was Carlos Santana, who, segue,
loves
has an amazing,
titty bars in Cleveland.
Who loves titty bars in Cleveland, has an amazing song in this soundtrack. But I was in Cleveland, I walked into a bar, and three, I'll tell you, Michael Brantley was 3 feet away from me. Carlos Santana was 3 feet away from me, and Lindor. So I guess it does happen. There was no, like, there was one, like, dude with security, but I easily could have walked up to them and, like, patted them on the belly. Like, it could have done anything. So, side story. Made me think of my Cleveland Indian story.
Well, Rob knows that we used to hang at lunch. We would go to the Quiznos and...
Who was there? Don Cherry?
No.
No, the manager of the Jays, and I can't even think of his name.
Gibby.
Oh, Gibby.
Gibby.
Gibby was always in there.
Yeah.
Gibby was hitting Quiznos on a daily basis.
What was his order? What was his order? I can't bet you it was like...
He liked to get the...
He's a Texan.
He used to get extra pepper.
Yeah.
Did you say anything to him?
Gibby would like. Gibby was wearing like slippers and like jeans. He because he lived in the condo upstairs. He was coming down like he was so chill. He didn't give a shit.
We said a couple things like just joking, and he went along with it totally. He was a nice guy. Yeah, he went along with it.
So. Everybody, I think, liked John Gibbons.
Yeah.
Benicio del Toro. Just to mention, like this cast is pretty stacked. You know what I mean? 1996, Benicio. You know,
playing Primo.
Juan Primo, man. He gets it. Like, you talk about Gil's killing. I actually really like the way that was shot, where he comes out and you don't think that he's killed, but then you got the flashbacks and, you know,
I thought he was overpowered. It seemed like Primo was dramatic. Stood up to him, right?
Yeah, right. You just see De Niro walking out and you don't know, oh, nothing happened. Then you, oh, no, something did happen.
And then, no, something did happen. He's wiping away the sweat. Then the Nine Inch Nails music comes on. And, like,
oh, yeah, that's
then,
right.
Like, that's a pretty effective scene. And, you know, this is we do horror films on this podcast, but that's like the thriller part of this movie, and I thought it was really good. So Benicio's in there, Juan Primo. You got John Leguizamo as the agent, the overbearing agent who's interested in the money. He's fast talking, fast moving. Is there anyone else? I'm going to bring somebody up when we go to the Running Scared Award, Rob. But is there anybody else we want to mention right now?
No one else for me. I'm good.
I do. I wanted to mention Juan Primo. So that means 11, right? His number was 11.
11, yeah.
Juan 1 and Primo 1 or something. So one.
Oh,
one.
I never picked that up.
Yeah.
Shit. Smart.
Oh, yeah. Man. That makes good, man. That's Juan Primo 1. Yeah, 1-1.
And that's why he's got it, like, not just tattooed, by the way, fucking carved into his arm.
That's right.
Branded.
Branded. Branded.
Like a cattle iron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He loses his pendant.
I actually really love that, by the way. It was like a really cool moment in the film because obviously the whole time you're like, why is he just giving the goddamn number? What's the big deal? He's offering him money. Rayburn's like throwing money at him, whatever.
500,000.
Exactly. And then you realize why it's so important to him. It's like, dude, it's like this number matters to me. Like, I'll show you how much. I branded my fucking self with this number.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, I just thought that was cool. It just really upped the ante.
Because De Niro said, why don't you want to go up your number? And then he showed him his shoulder, right, with the branding.
Yeah.
From here, I think there's a couple things you want to talk about. Do you have a childhood connection? Not childhood, a teenagehood connection to this film. Our buddy Jesse and you enjoyed this
night,
a night of tea watching, tea drinking, I believe.
Yeah, a little. You know, I tell you, this is gonna get out. But
you're a teacher. I forgot.
Yeah, let's keep this on the. Let's just keep this in code. Let's talk in code, boys. No,
you visited the dragon.
Yeah,
the white snake.
Under the influence, we'll say that. So we go up. So basically, Jesse just moved up to. You know, he's my childhood friend. He's just moved up to Newmarket, and his mom and dad have just bought a new house there, right? And Jesse and I decided to just get under the influence before we went up. Unbeknownst to me, as soon as I got there, I was getting the full fucking house tour from his parents. I was not in a mental state. The only thing I could say was, the only thing I said for about 25 minutes they had to know was, it's a nice place. It's a nice place.
I remember this.
I kept saying it over and over again. And then Jesse and I eventually get down to the basement. And you know what I mean? He's hit Blockbuster before I went up there, and he's got the fan. I had no idea like what he picked. This was like 97, I guess. 98. And we watched the movie, and honestly, this movie's a little bit trippy because there's one scene where Rayburn comes up and De Niro's there. And you know, Rayburn's walking by, and De Niro, if you watch this, he's got the glasses on. He's going, Bobby. And then the Juan Primo scene where the music comes in and he's like, you know what I mean? There's a huge intensification in like in the way you would psychologically interpret that scene. And then the end, I feel like kind of for me, it plateaus before and then it kind of like falls a little bit flat at the end. But there's just kind of some funny points. And also, Winston, you talked about this, right? Like kind of just, you said earlier in the pod, like kind of just De Niro being De Niro, right? When he gets really verbose and he does his like, he does his De Niro thing. That yeah. can, you know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about. Like he does it in all his films, right? But it definitely was a good experience.
Did you not think as a sports movie that like this movie was going to culminate like at the championship or something? Like I know that's cliche, but at the same
like
time,
the major league, like you were going to get the whole.
Yeah, well, I thought it'd be more like the stakes would be driven up on both sides of the story. So the stakes are driven up obviously by De Niro by kidnapping the kid, and now he's making Rayburn. He says you got to hit a home run for me. And I thought it was going to be driven up by a side story being that they're also getting into the playoffs or whatever it is.
Right.
And then, so I wanted to get to that scene you were talking about, Winston, where you mentioned that scene where it's raining. They're just getting fucking monsoon poured on. And they decide to intentionally walk Rayburn.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, this is where you're going to, like Rayburn now needs to get them to pitch to him and they won't do it. And I thought he's going to point. He's going to do the Babe Ruth point.
Watch this. Taylor is pointing to the bleachers. He's calling his shot.
Just to like get them mad at him and be like, I'm going to hit a home run here. And he's like, which is what Gil would want him to do because he wants him to hit a home run. So all these like things, I was like, oh man, I know that's maybe too cliche, but it made me think like how else, like if your son is on the line, you're going to do anything to like get this guy to pitch to you because you have to hit a home run. So I would have, I thought he was going to point and then the pitcher was going to get mad and be like, fine, fuck you. I'll try to strike you out. And then, you know, then we get our, and we don't quite get a home run. We get an in the park home run, which I thought was also very interesting. And somehow Gil has got himself down into the stadium.
Yeah, that was not real clear.
Taking like, out an umpire like Leslie Nielsen style with Naked Gun. What's the line? Hey, it's Benicio. Oh, fuck. You guys remember this when he sings the national anthem, the Naked Gun? And then he puts on the umpire outfit. So when they reveal who it is, the guy stands up in the crowd and goes,
hey, it's Enrico Palazzo.
It's,
what is the line?
What's the line?
I don't remember the line.
I'll drop it in.
I thought I'd missed something too. I'm glad you. I didn't know how he got into that umpire.
How did he get down? Because you see him in like the anals of the like the stadium.
Anal?
I was wondering where you were going with this.
He gets down into the umpire room somehow, and then he's there. I had less of a problem with that climax, Rob. Like because this movie was not based around the team.
I know, but it would have added drama.
Yeah, I know, but we do get that. We get a fight. We get an in the park home run. What the fuck is more exciting than that, man?
No, but I just why not?
You want the Field of Dreams ending.
I do think they could have done more to make it interesting because Gil is so obsessed with San Fran like winning that like why not add that story to it in the set? Like you could have the radio fucking cover it for you.
So that's interesting,
just make
right?
it a playoff game or make it a game that makes or breaks them getting into the playoffs.
I was thinking, it's the World Series. It's in New York. Gil follows the team to New York. His son is on the Empire State Building.
Yeah, there you go.
I like that.
That's really up it.
Yeah, up it.
What I also liked here was that when the cops do get on the field and surround him, surround him in a circle. So that when they shoot him, they're basically firing at each other.
That was good, yes.
It was so like, what is happening here?
What does that mean?
This is like a... There's well, like another, a
it's high it, drama.
It, yeah.
Another thing that I remember too, now when that final scene, everything's on the video on the Jumbotron, right?
Yeah. It's all being filmed. Yeah,
everybody
like
can
you go
see.
To a you go to a Jays game, they won't even show a replay of a controversial. Like, oh, that guy out? Oh, they won't show it. It's too controversial. They're showing live like murder live on the Jumbotron. Yeah.
Before we wrap all this up with our final section, let's talk about that soundtrack because it is insane how much money the soundtrack must have costed. So I'm just going to break down a few things. You've already mentioned some of these, Jamie's. Three Rolling Stones songs.
Yeah.
Nine Inch Nails is thrown like a towel across several scenes. They just like use Nine Inch Nails and whatever they don't know what to do, just drop another Nine Inch Nails song. I think there's three Nine Inch Nails songs.
Yeah, when they want murder, when they want aggression, when they want... It's funny. Yeah. That's Gil's leitmotif, eh?
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, that's you know
good,
what I mean?
It's a good point.
Yeah, like they've really kind of married that that band to him.
Which feels weird because he's not of that time at all. Like, he's a Stones fan.
That's true.
Maybe
he,
you know what?
Deliberately, he actually says he knows Mick Jagger several times in the movie.
I believe he had Mick Jagger in his shrine.
They've also got a Massive Attack song in here. Santana, as you mentioned. Aaron Neville makes an appearance in this movie singing the national anthem.
Yeah.
Hans Zimmer does the original soundtrack. They've even got the Bem Bem Maria by the Gypsy Kings in this movie.
So that's...
are French. Has nothing to do with a South American player, Primo, who's supposed to be from South America. Gypsy Kings are not from South America.
You know what? That was actually an interesting point I just want to pull up there, is that often, if you're going to go with a contemporary soundtrack, you're going to go, you know, contemporary. You may have like a theme song, but you're going to go contemporary music through the whole film. Or if you're going to score it with a Williams or a Zimmer or whoever, often you're going to get that scoring through. And then you may get like one track that kind of, you know, is like an antithesis piece to what the score is trying to do. This one had both, right? This one had Zimmer throughout in little sort of atmospheric pieces, and then had Nine Inch Nails as that lead motif, and then had the Rolling Stones, and then paints in a beautiful picture with Samba Pati, the Santana track, the instrumental, which is a beautiful song that that is connected with Primo in his death. So, like, for me, the pieces make sense, and I think there's clearly a lot of thought and thinking behind it. But Rob, yeah, like, there's just, it's very all over the place in terms of where they're picking this music from for this movie.
Well, you put a note here too that you found it interesting, like, for a baseball movie, not much like Americana kind of music.
Yeah, there's no Americana in here at all. And again, with a baseball film, even you had like The Last Boy Scout, you had a little bit of rock in there. In any of the baseball movies, from The Natural, The Field of Dreams, to Snipes' other film, fucking Willie Mays Hayes, Major League, one of the best movies ever, right? You got that ding, 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 you have something completely different, which again, that just is flies in my theory that like this was Tony Scott just trying shit. You know what I mean? And for lack of a better way to explain what this film is, because in his filmography, his movie is very different, and the choices that he makes in this film are very different than what he did previous and then after.
And maybe you learned from it.
he learned who to date.
The one thing we haven't really talked about is kind of overall with the film. So maybe we can save that for our rating, or do you guys want to dive into sort of, we haven't really talked about like, what do we think of the film kind of as a whole, but I think that could work better in our rating. So why don't we before we get to rating though, let's do, Winston's probably not too aware of this, but Winston, we'd like to do something called the Running Scared Award in every episode where we look for the actor or, you know, character or someone that we felt in this movie got the most exercise in this film. So when you're looking at this film, is there anyone who specifically looks like they really like got some calories, like burned some calories making this thing?
Well, you gotta go with Wesley Snipes in the park home run. How far did it? How far is that? 90 feet times four is 360 feet.
Yeah,
in the rain.
Yeah,
son's about to be killed by a madman. He's stressed. I'm going to give it to Rayburn or Wesley Snipes.
All right. That's pretty kind of obvious.
I'm going to come in with, I like that. I like that, Winston. I'm going to come in with Chris Mulkey.
Jamie always loves to do the fucking off the board ones.
Tim.
I didn't know you could go off the board.
Who's this Tim?
The husband.
Oh, Ted.
Oh, my God. Is that Ted? Tim? Ted?
Ted?
Ted. This guy. So Gil is belligerent up to this guy's face. This guy completely is unwilling to stand up. So the wife is going to have him fucking running errands all day long, fucking vacuuming the house.
Oh, my God.
Taking him to fucking Walmart. This guy's getting his steps in. It's Chris Mulkey. He's getting the Running Scared Award.
I wonder where you're going with that. That's good. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
Rob,
you made that, Rob? Well, he made me think. You made me think maybe Patty Ellen deserved it just for her like rages at Gil. I thought she probably burns a lot of cows for that.
Oh, yeah, that's
And I kind of wanted to give it to Garrity just because the boss, Gil's boss, who stabs the door numerous times to show how sharp the knives are.
Dan Butler,
another that guy kind of actor. But I'm actually going to give it to Charles Hallahan, a.k.a. Coop. Because Coop not only plays a little ball with a psychopath, but he fucking throws the kid over the fence to try to get him out of there.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
You know, doesn't really put up a great fight, but, you know, he's a big man and he's doing what he can. And he's doing what he can do to save that kid's life. And that's what it came down to for him. So I think he got his adrenaline going probably the highest.
I just thought of something. I know I've already given my pick for Running Scared Award, but I just thought of the obvious choice. The Hasidic Jewish man who was, yes. He was running scared. He really was running scared when that knife came through the
door. That motherfucker was running scared.
Yeah, he knew it was time to go. On the Running Scared podcast, we'd like to give a rating out of 5 footsteps. 5 being a great movie that outruns its killer by quite a few steps, or a 1 step would be this movie got by the killer in this case, that being a low rating and something that we thought wasn't that great. I think I'll want me to kick it off here for the ratings, guys.
Yeah,
okay,
go ahead, Rob.
So I'm gonna not give this movie a great rating. I think what you've got here is a movie that is filmed really well, looks good, great acting, not even a bad story. It just doesn't come together to equal up to anything. There's no real good scares. I'm never really thrilled. Like, I'm not I don't feel chills by De Niro's character. It feels very predictable in most cases. Like, you know what he's going to do in this scene. You know what's going to happen in this scene. There's maybe only at the end where it starts to get a little crazy, where I'm like, oh, okay, he's going to throw knives at people on the field. He's going to kill John Crook, which I didn't see that coming. But overall, like, I just find like the pieces don't add up. There's some drama left on the table, like I was mentioning earlier. And I just don't think like enough happens to make us care one way or the other about Gil. And even Rayburn, although we like him, I don't know if we love him enough to like say, I mean, we don't want a kid to die, but at the same time, we don't, we don't fall in love with him as like a person. And I think we come to understand him and realize that he's a complex man who has like his own way of interpreting the star, like living in the starlight that he has to do. But I don't know. I just don't find this movie kind of goes far enough in any particular direction to make me think, you know, oh, wow, that was interesting. It all just kind of like sings a song that you've heard before. And really pointing back to what Winston, you said, is that De Niro is essentially playing a version or a derivative of other characters that he's played before. So I'm only going to give this one about 2.5 steps out of 5.
2.5.
Not that it's a horrible movie. It was like okay to watch, has a great soundtrack, but it just doesn't leave you much more. It's kind of like a hamburger from McDonald's or something. Like, it's okay.
I like hamburgers from McDonald's.
Yeah, but like, I'm not going to give it 4 stars either.
Cheeseburger?
Yeah, but then, no, it's never going to get to that level, man. Like, come on.
I'm going to kind of piggyback on some of that, Rob. I think after watching the movie again and then thinking back to when I watched it as a kid, like, the things that stick out of my mind are things that I find funny, where, you know, he's with the kid and then he decides he's gonna leave to go to his appointment, right? And the kid's like sitting in a giant stadium by himself. Or he is going to the Little League and he's, you know, like I mentioned earlier, he's yelling, mix in some strikes. Like, he's being just like this caricature of himself. I think that there's a couple of cool scenes. And I think, you know, we didn't even talk about how he was able to fucking descend 300 feet off a cliff to go save Wesley Snipes' kid, Sean. You know what I mean? Like, he's got the binoculars out. He's there. Sean goes in the water. Psh, she's down, psh, like 300 feet down a cliff, sheer face. He's in the water all before Snipes can get down off his like balcony that's maybe 50 feet away, right? Which is ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. And then he's in the Atlanta Braves jersey. They're playing catch. She's shooting pool. Like it, the movie at the beginning is kind of, it reminds me of Barbarian, where it's kind of like paced a certain way. And then all of a sudden they felt like, oh shit, man, we're not making De Niro crazy enough. We got to get him going. Yeah. We got to get this movie moving towards like a thriller. And then they just amp up the story, and it just kind of all seems too fast, and it's not realistic.
Well, and killing Primo, like, it's like nothing got in the way of that. He didn't have to kill someone else first.
Well, he just
no complication.
You know what my word for this film is? Access. This guy has unprecedented access to everything fucking San Francisco Giants. That's my biggest issue, right? Access. Okay? Which makes it like unrealistic. He's able to access whatever he wants. So I think for all those reasons, the movie is not as strong as I think I'd like to remember when I was high on mushrooms when I was 17 years old. So that's the thing. So
Bobby.
Bobby. So for me, I'm gonna come in with with 2.5 footsteps. I'm gonna give the same rating as Rob, and that's where I land with 1996, The Fan.
Well, Winston? It's all on you, Winston. How does this fall into your dark world of sports?
Well, you know, there are some things that are so wildly wrong with this movie, it's almost fun to watch. Like the torrential downpour for the final scene, and all the goofs with the baseball. So there are, but I think that's, you know, as far as the movie, it's a bit of a mess for me. I kind of was into it for the first half, but it really just in the end, I think it's just sort of style over substance.
Like, yeah,
a lot of stuff looked good. There's some cool things, but yeah, as Rob said, it doesn't really come together, and the surprises, even though. The surprises I more like laugh at than, like, for instance, the umpire all of a sudden kills the umpire. It doesn't shock me. It's like, what the fuck? What was that? It was more just laughable surprises as opposed to. So, I'm going to have to just only give it one, I'm afraid. One.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Jesus.
It didn't do it for me, guys. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know what? I have a follow-up question, Winston. This is another segment that we always do here on Running Scared.
Okay.
Is The Fan better or worse than Anaconda?
Oh, boy. I'm going to have to say worse.
Yes.
Rob? No,
it's worse than Anaconda.
Really? Okay. Robert.
You know what? Honestly, and I'm not just saying it just because...
Because we love Anaconda?
Just because you guys have both said no. It is worse than Anaconda.
Yeah.
Anaconda is a better movie than The Fan.
Yeah, I would give it that, honestly. Like, I do think that as silly as Anaconda is, structurally, story-wise, pacing, fun, thrilling, acting, all that, like, I actually think Anaconda hits more marks.
Yeah, we don't need to, like, right. Yeah, we've already done 5 podcasts on it, so I'm not sure we need to go into it now, but, like, we're talking quality cast. There's a Harbinger. There's, you know, we're gonna talk about it again in episode 50. That's coming up again.
One thing about The Fan that did kind of hit me was that you got Snipes, you got De Niro,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you would think you could come up with something, a character that's a little more three dimensional than that. So,
anyway. Well, listen. Winston, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
For this episode. This is really good. Good conversation, funny, and knowledgeable. Thanks for letting us into kind of your brain on the dark side of sports. And that's amazing that you're doing that. Anybody that is listening, check that out. The Dark Side of Sports.
Can we be brother or sister? Well, we'll be brother podcasts.
Absolutely, yeah.
And share through both podcasts.
Exactly.
T-shirts.
Sounds good.
You know, I may have to change my podcast, The Dark. I think there's one called, there already is one, The Dark Side of Sports. So I'm going to be The Dark Side of Sport, singular.
Yeah. Well, we had that happen to us too. We have we found someone else came up with Running Scared after us.
Yeah,
and
after us.
There's something that we do besides after movie reviews. We do a thing called Jogcast where we make original like horror movies for jogging. And this person does true crime stories for jogging, which we feel is a little too close to our brand to have the same name.
Yeah, when I first heard the Jogcast, I thought this is something different. But so if someone else is doing it, I think that's well, they do say plagiarism is a good form of flattery.
Yeah, this podcast came to light after ours has been on the air, and the one thing with our Jogcast, and anybody that's listening knows that because we definitely talk about it. Although we haven't spoken about it much in the last few podcasts, but we create original stories. These are like movies for your ears, and the more we create them, I think the better they are. Rob and I are getting closer on the latest one. We just sort of unlocked a little piece that was, I think, holding us back. So I think, you know, this is something that's going to become a priority for us to kind of get done, along with getting to episode 50. Once again, you can find us at Running Scared PD on Twitter. You can find us Instagram at Running Scared Pod. You can send us an email at the Running Scared Podcast at gmail.com, or you can always support us through our Patreon / Running Scared. We always appreciate the support, kind of increasing our roster incrementally. So we always respect and really thank the people that are taking time to support us in doing what we do. So Rob, if there isn't anything else we need to mention, again, thank you, Winston. Thank you, Rob. And we'll see you next time on Running Scared.
The Running Scared podcast is written and produced by Jamie Roberts and Robert Lendrum, with original music by Jamie Roberts. This episode also edited by Jamie Roberts. Find us on social media and tune in next time for a movie review or a Jogcast on Running Scared.
No, don't shoot!
He's not my son!
Now do you care?
Bobby! Now do you care?